Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Don't miss out on amazing end-of-sale savings on bedding, curtains and more. Available now in-store or at harrycurry.com.
0818 715 815.
Hello there, a very good afternoon and you're welcome to Liveline. It's John Cook with you until 3 o'clock today. Good to talk to you and I hope you're well. It's 51551. For your text to get in touch on WhatsApp, it's 087-484-8888 and liveline@rte.ie for your emails as well. And many businesses still getting in touch with us about possible closure today. So I'm wondering, will this 9% VAT rate save you from that closure? Will it do, as the Taoiseach said, to look after those small community hub type businesses, those cafes in rural Ireland? And what about the hotels or the shops or the pubs or the other facilities maybe that don't get it? Or tell me more, because I'd love to know. And as well, the Taoiseach did also say that the VAT cut, in an interview in The Examiner I was reading, should be reflected in the amount you pay for your cake and coffee, for the bills you pay in your local restaurant or cafe. Do you think that'll happen? 087-484-8888. Or will you get a cut price on the cost of your colour, blow dryer, highlights at the hairdressers? Because they're getting the VAT cut too. It's 51551 for your texts. I'd love to hear from you. Terry Brannigan, good afternoon to you.
Hi, how are you?
Terry, I'm very well. And you?
Good, thank you.
Terry, it's good to hear, because you're going to tell us, I suppose, about feeling good after many, many years when you didn't feel well. Take us back to when that happened, or what age were you, please?
I was 14 when I first started having symptoms of Crohn's disease, so just over 24 years ago.
Mm-hmm. And can you explain, Terry, what Crohn's disease is for people who don't understand?
So Crohn's disease is an inflammatory bowel disease that can affect your whole digestive tract, so from your mouth the whole way down. It can cause vomiting, diarrhea, pain, joint swelling, and a host of other issues as well.
A lot of issues that people are probably uncomfortable talking about sometimes, and I apologise to anyone who's offended by that. But is it something, Terry, you struggled to talk about? I mean, you were just 14 years of age going through these problems.
Yeah, I'll be honest, only up until probably the last maybe 10 years or so, I hated talking about it. Obviously, at 14, 15 years of age, you don't want to be talking about having diarrhoea all the time. Mm-hmm. So it's not a topic that you'd be quickly talking to your friends about, especially not in school.
It must have been so difficult, Terry, in school and hanging out with your teenage friends, when I suppose you're always wondering, will I be sick? Can I eat? Or is it that bad? Because I think you lived in fear of eating for a time.
I did, yeah, for a long time. I wouldn't eat if I was going to school or if I wanted to go out with my friends. I'd maybe have my breakfast, but then not eat anything else throughout the day, purely out of fear, because any time I ate, it came with pain and then diarrhea soon after as well. Mm-hmm. And not just once, it would be multiple times. So, yeah, I lived in constant fear when I ate, to be honest.
It sounds highly distressing, Terry, especially for anyone to deal with, especially a young person. And I'm assuming that took its toll or had an impact on what you couldn't, what you could and couldn't do as a teenager.
It did, yeah. Yeah. So I spent a lot of my teenage years in and out of hospital, and just trying to navigate that and try to keep some sort of a social life. So I was lucky enough to have a great group of friends that I'm still very close with now. So they've seen me grow up with this. But at the time, it was quite difficult for sure.
Mm-hmm. Were there things you missed out on?
Yeah, I missed out on a lot of things. I missed out on a lot of school. Probably didn't mind that too much at the time.
At the time, it seemed good.
Yeah. I did miss out on a lot of school, but a lot of social events as well. So as a teenager, you obviously want to be out and about with your friends, but unfortunately, yeah, did miss out on a huge amount of that.
There's a lot to take in. This diagnosis, did you understand it, Terry? I'm sure you were wondering why it was affecting you and not your friends.
It was a lot to take in at the time, but it took 6 months for me to get a diagnosis. So at that time, I think I was just happy to know what was going on. Because as I said, the symptoms started the summer before I went into third year, so just before I turned 15. So not knowing what it was and being in and out of hospital and A&E and thinking that I had a bug constantly and wondering why that wasn't going away. To finally put a name on it, it kind of gives you a little bit of clarity, and you kind of then get the sense that, okay, this is something that can be managed. It's never going to be fixed, but it can be managed.
And is that what you were told, Terry? Because difficult and all as it is to deal with those symptoms, in getting a diagnosis at last, you maybe knew what it was or what to expect. You were told this is something you'll have to live with, but you can manage.
Yeah. I was told that it could be treated with medication, which it can for a lot of people. Unfortunately, a lot of the medications just didn't work for me over the years. I was on many of them, so...
Mm-hmm. And then there are various other treatments or, I suppose, other methods used, I suppose, in managing the illness as well. Tell me when you were first told about a stoma bag.
I was actually first told about a stoma bag when I was 17. I had to go have half my colon removed. And at the time, they warn you that it is a possibility that when they go in and have a look, that they might need to take more than they intend to, which could result in a stoma bag. At the time, obviously at 17, would have been the worst thing in the world for me. But years later, 10 years ago, I actually asked my team in the hospital, could I speak to the surgeon? And I wanted to request to get a stoma bag.
Age 17, you must have been very upset when you realised this was maybe in your future. It sounds like your reaction was, no, it's not.
Yeah, at that point, it was 100%. I didn't want it, as any 17-year-old would feel at the time. You've got your whole life ahead of you. You don't want to be going to school. And the initial thoughts of it as well and what it is, it can be quite daunting, especially for a 17-year-old to try wrap your head around that. It's a lot. Thankfully, it didn't happen at 17. So I was lucky enough in that sense.
Do you remember how it was explained to you at that age, Terry?
Yeah, a stoma nurse came in to see me and she just basically said that there is a possibility that during the surgery they might need to take out more. And if they do, they will have to bring part of my... Now, at the time, they didn't know whether it was going to be the ileum, so the small intestine, or the large intestine, the colon, out to the surface of your stomach through your abdomen, and that they would then attach a bag to that to collect your faeces.
It's a lot to take in, isn't it, for anyone at any age?
Yeah.
And you were afraid of that, I would think, as well, understandably.
I was, of course, yeah, because I was still in school. I hadn't done my leaving cert yet. So I wanted to go to college. There was loads of things that I wanted to do. And in my head at that point, I just couldn't fathom the idea of having a bag at that point. So. Mm-hmm.
And then from what you tell us, and I suppose the period of time you waited, Terry, you carried on with medication, and I'm probably assuming some difficult symptoms over the years afterwards.
Yeah, some very difficult symptoms. I went through essentially all the medications that were available for Crohn's disease and even trialled out some medications that weren't necessarily marketed for Crohn's disease at the time, but that they were seeing... possibilities that they could work for Crohn's disease. So I went through a lot of medications, and unfortunately the ones that did work I ended up being allergic to, or they stopped working after a period of time. And I was on trial drugs. There was a few where we thought this was going to work and this is going to be my saving grace, but unfortunately it was never the case. And at my worst, after a trial that I went on, I couldn't walk, my muscles had deteriorated, my potassium levels were so low because I was going to the bathroom up to 60, 70 times a day, that I was on a heart monitor constantly.
60 or 70 times a day, Terry, I'm sorry, that's really difficult.
Yeah. I was essentially glued to the bathroom, and at that point I was in so much pain that I would have to bring a bowl with me as well because I was vomiting at the same time. So it was very tough.
It was, and you speak about it with such strength as well, because life has changed for you. So tell me how you came around to this idea, I'm going to need a more long-term solution here. I can't live like this.
Yeah. Well, that last time where I was going 60, 70 times a day, I came in my mind anyway. I think it's the first time that I realised how close I had come to death, especially when I had come out of it. I realised how close I had been, especially with the fact that I was on a heart monitor constantly and I couldn't walk, all these kind of things. I was very weak. It took a long time for me to recover from that. But during my recovery, that was when I said, I've had enough now. I can't do this anymore. If I want to have any bit of a life, I think I need to start looking into having a bag. So I started doing my own research. I was on steroids at the time, so I was usually awake throughout the night, wide awake at the time. Mm-hmm. So I'd be Googling everything and looking up forums for people that had stomas. And I just decided it was the best thing for me. So I sat down with my family and I just said, look, I'm going to ask for this. And we went in to see the medical team and they agreed that I could talk to the surgeon, but they didn't think the surgeon would agree with me at the time. But thankfully he did. Mm-hmm. He agreed that I was ready for the surgery and that it would be the best thing for me. And within 6 days I was in, having the rest of my colon removed.
It's a big decision and a brave one, it sounds, Terry, as well. Do you remember that time or waking up after surgery or procedures to realise what had happened and how did that feel?
I do. I remember it very well. I remember that day being very, very sick and my family being with me in the hospital. And I had been okay leading up to the surgery, but the day of, I was very sick. So it kind of solidified in my head that I was doing the right thing. And then I was wheeled off to surgery. We all had a couple of tears and said our goodbyes and all that. Mm-hmm. And then when I was brought back out, the first thing that I said to my mum was, I'm not in pain anymore. And I'd been in pain for 15 odd years, so it was just normal for me. But to wake up, for that to be the first thing to say, it was huge for me. And I know it was huge for my family to kind of say, OK, she's done the right thing.
Wow. 15 years in pain. And maybe only then you actually realised that this wasn't something you had to live with.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd always had some sort of, even when I was well, I use air quotes when I say that, mm-hmm. I always had some sort of pain. So there was always like low grade pain there of some sort. And so to wake up and be completely out of pain. Now, obviously, the next day and the recovery and all that, I was in tremendous pain after the surgery, but mm-hmm. I didn't feel as unwell mm-hmm. or sick or weak at the time. So
was it hard to get used to, Terry, and try to get back to normal?
It was. I'm not ever going to lie about it and say, because I personally love it now. It's the best thing ever. But the first year, I would say, was difficult. I did get an infection in my wound as well. So I had drains attached to me for a couple of months afterwards.
Right.
So it was difficult. And you're also getting used to a new way of living. You've now got a bag attached to you and you need to learn how to look after that and like make sure. It's a big thing to get used to. Like you constantly, for me anyway, I know I was forever asking my mum, can you smell something? Because I was convinced that I smelled.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't, but it was just a mental block that I had with it. So once I kind of got over everything and started just looking after it myself, which I jumped into quite quickly, within a day or two of the surgery, I was changing the bag myself. I just threw myself into it because I knew if I didn't that my recovery was probably going to be slower and I'd end up having people mm-hmm. needing people to do it for me, and I didn't want that. The idea of me getting the bag was to get my independence back.
Mm-hmm. I believe you were out. You're out running in the mornings now. You're on the beach. You're big into exercise, Terry.
I am. I'm competing. Well, I wouldn't say competing, but I'm taking part in Troika at the weekend, which is kind of the Irish version of High Rocks, to celebrate 10 years of having a stoma bag.
Wow.
So,
what's involved? Is it like a triathlon or something? No, or
it's running. It's an endurance race. So you have to run, and which I'm terrible at. I'm very slow, but I'm going to do it anyway. So you have to run, and then you have to lift weights, and you have to pull a sled with 100 kilos on it and push a sled and do loads of crazy things. But
wow. Best of luck with that.
My brave friend Blanet has decided to take this challenge on.
It
with
must
me,
be
so
a great feeling
through.
To be able to do it. Are there things you can't do now with a stoma bag?
No, there's nothing I can't do. Which
isn't that a great thing
to say?
Isn't it a great thing to be able to say, Terry?
I couldn't even walk down the road for 2 minutes without needing to find a bathroom. I could tell you where, still to this day, I can tell you where every bathroom is from Bray to Dundrum along the road. I can tell you where they all are. But I hike, I run, I go to the gym, I swim, I do everything now. So It's honestly been the best thing that I've ever done.
It's 51551 if listeners want to get in touch with their experience as well. I'd say they're impressed by you, Terry. And you've raised another issue too, which I often think about as someone who travels a lot. And thankfully, I don't need to go as often as you've explained to us there. But where are the public toilets too? Because I know lots of people struggle to find them convenient as well. Liveline@rte.ie if you want to get in touch. How have people reacted to your story over the years then, Terry? Or you've got support of friends, as you said. Do you think there's still a stigma, or do people treat you differently?
I don't think anybody treats me differently at all. I've gotten a huge amount of support over the last couple of weeks, as I've been in the newspaper and I've done some fundraising as well over the last few weeks for Crohn's and Colitis Ireland. So I've gotten a huge amount of support, and honestly, like, friends that I've met since having the bag, I tell them about it and they kind of go, okay, perfect, yeah, that's just who you are. Nobody really bats an eyelid. People ask me questions, but I think because I'm so open about it, I'm happy to answer any of the questions, and nothing's off topic. They can ask me whatever they want. I will answer it. So I think maybe because I'm so happy with it that people kind of see that it's not necessarily a bad thing to have.
Mm-hmm. Terry, thanks so much for talking to us on Liveline today. I'm so inspired, as I think other people will be, by your story, and particularly some of the things you just said there. There's nothing I can't do. 51551. Good luck with Trica, and good health and happiness to you, Terry. Thanks very much for joining us there. I also like that Terry said nothing's off topic. That's what we're about here on Liveline as well. 51551 or liveline@rte.ie.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815.
And 51551 for your text. Dominic, good afternoon to you. How are you, Dominic?
Not too bad at all, not too bad at all then.
Very good. Were you always into water safety yourself, Dominic?
Oh, I would always been, yeah. In my younger days, I was a lifeguard, swimming instructor as well, and involved in water safety. So that's how I got annoyed when I spotted the life ring inside the canal.
Mm-hmm. We'll come to that in just a second. You grew up by the water. Tell us where.
Oh, I'm Kerry, in Tralee County, Kerry. I grew up by Euphenus, you've Ballybunnan, you've the Maharees, you've some excellent beaches down this side of the country.
Beautiful
places.
And
it's places. Great to get out, you know. Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's absolutely fabulous.
Mm-hmm. So water safety is obviously very important to you, as well as obviously enjoying it as well. So what did you see?
Well, just a simple thing, just taking my son to work, and there's a beautiful walk from Tralee out to Brinnell to the canal, and people do use it regularly, and you have a lot of people on it, and that. So I was driving my young son to work, and I noticed that one of the life rings was tossed into the canal.
Mm-hmm.
So on my way back, I noticed the life ring was still there, and nobody had went to pick it up. So I went along to my walk, picked it up, retied it, and put it back in its position, and made sure everything was okay with us on that. So it's happened there a couple of times. Like, I think it's been highlighted locally that the life rings are being taken out of their holders, because life rings, by definition of life rings, they're very easy access and they're very easy pull out, and you can sling them off and they fly off away like that, you know. So that's why I took it upon myself to pick it up and make it safe, put it back in its place, so if anybody needed it and they went back, they would actually find it there.
I know where you mean. It is a beautiful walk, the Tralee to Blennerville Canal there. When you, maybe if I or someone else was passing by or walking by it, we see the empty holder for the life buoy. We see it's not there where it should be. We don't think anything of it. When you see it, you're worried.
Oh, I would be, yes. I would worry, yes. Because life savings, it's such a simple device that you can just put into the water if somebody falls in, like, the canal. Like, if they fall into the canal, they're not too far away from the side, and you can use it to throw in the life ring to get them or to help them out. And the thing about the life rings is it doesn't protect the person you're saving. It also protects the person that's using the life ring, because obviously when somebody's drowning, they're very agitated, they're very stressed. And if you touch them or come very close to them or put your hand out, the possibility of them dragging you in mm-hmm. with them is very high. So having a life ring with a rope on it into them, get them to grab a hold of it and pull them back in is very important. So that's why, look, I think other people would probably do exactly as I would have done like that, you know.
But you see it in the water. And this has come up on the programme before. We hear of people them going missing or being vandalised. I mean, would you consider this as reckless as vandalism, just knowing that it is not there, that it's not there to do its job if needed in an emergency?
Well, I would think so. But like, I know like the persons or people who did it might have thought it was fun at the time. And, you know, they might have said, let's toss this in like that. And if somebody does go along and do that, by all means, you have it done, but take it back and put it back in its position, because you never know when you might need it. And the thing about it is, it's a simple little device, and they're placed along the canal about 100 metres apart on that, and they're there for a particular reason mm-hmm. on that.
And Dominic, I'm interested, you explain it quite well, just what you're supposed to do with a life buoy. Have you ever had to use one to help somebody in trouble in the water?
I would have throughout the years as a lifeguard, a pool lifeguard and on a beach lifeguard. And one day I was off on a beach and I was off duty going along, and I spotted somebody getting caught in a rip current, and they were being swept out. Not like they might have been fine, but I got involved and went down and threw in the life ring and got them out and obviously put it back. But see, the thing is, again, like when you use these devices, you're not close to the person, you're away from them. And even if they come after you, sometimes they might pull up along the rope to come and catch you or to grab you. You can actually walk away from them and talk to them. But like what I would like to see actually, and just digressing from the actual subject, that like when I was teaching, what I would do is the last, you'd have teaching going on, you'd have a 4-week course. And on the last night, I would tell the people, come in your clothes, I'll get you to swim in the pool in your clothes, and I'll teach you how to use a life ring. Because there's a way in using them, how you use them, and people should use them a lot more. So I'd love to see lifeguards and beach areas like this have life rings alongside the hut and let people take them out and look at them and use them and see how they work and how easy they are to actually to a device to work.
Okay, say come and use it, come and see how it works, see how you throw it. Maybe people would understand or respect it a bit more, you think, rather than taking it, throwing it away or putting rubbish on them, I think, in some cases as well, as it seems to happen around the country.
Well, yes, no, and that's another thing I've spotted as well. Like, you know, like even when I'm walking on the beach and I go up and I'd look at the life rings, I'd check them. Sometimes you'd look into them, there could be broken bottles, glass inside it. I know people are thinking it might be safer to put them up there, but it's not a place to put when you put your hand in and grab them there like that to go away. So, like, I've seen at times, like, nappies being thrown into these little holders as well. So, like, I'm sure the council times go in and clean these out, because I would spot it and you'd come back and they'd be re-cleaned out again. I think it's educating people that these are a simple little device. They should be respected. They should be left in their place. And to members of the public, if they do see them on the, let's say, in the canal or anything like that, or on the beach out of their holders, to take the time to go up and fix them and look at them. Mm-hmm. Ideally, go to the next one that's there, that's in position, and have a look at that. Because sometimes when you deploy these, sometimes they might have a little rubber ring around them. It just holds the fold of the rope, that when you throw it out, it unfolds. But sometimes it mightn't have a fold, it might get knotted up a bit. So just to have a look at what you're actually doing as well.
And you've raised such a good point, Dominic. Thank you. When you think of the life buoy, you forget sometimes. It's so simple, but so effective, as you're saying. So maybe we don't realise how important it was. If we see a defibrillator, I was thinking, they're in their own phone boxes these days in many communities as well. Maybe you stand back a bit, because that looks a little bit more technical. Although, actually, I think we hear stories of vandalism there too. People just need to respect life-saving devices and leave them alone.
Exactly. Like, look, what harm are they? They're there. They're doing no harm to anybody. You can see them at all times. They're very highlighted. They've got this red and yellow color, so you'd spot them quite a distance mm-hmm. away like that. Just leave them alone. But as I say, the young people that were probably, or whoever, I can't say whoever it was, young people, old people, I'm not trying to target young people, but whoever the people were, just didn't realise what they were doing. Uh-huh. I would rather say that than, so it was total vandalism, do you know?
Dominic, thanks so much for joining us on the programme today. It's 0818715815 if you want to get in touch. And he raises a great point as well, of having more life buoys or more opportunities for people to touch them, hold them, throw them, see how you would use them in an emergency if you're walking along the water all the time. There's some some great groups out there as well who've trained people to use defibrillators as well in this way too. So I'd love to know if it's a story want to share with us as well, or whether you've similar incidents to report. It's 51551 if you want to get in touch with us today. And many still getting in touch on the budget as well. And I want to know if this 9% VAT rate, it won't come in until next July. So will it save your local cafe, your pub or your restaurant? And what about the small businesses that are contacting us who don't qualify for the lower VAT rate? It's 087 484 8888 by WhatsApp if you want to get in touch. Deirdre, good afternoon.
Hi, John. How are you?
I'm well. Tell me a little bit about your business, will you?
Well, I'm Deirdre from McMullins in Arklow. We're a ladies' clothes shop. We're approaching our centenary. We'll be 100 years here in 2028.
Wow.
So we've been around a long time and we've seen a lot of stuff going on. But we pay, well, the customer pays 23% VAT on everything that we sell. Like, that's nearly a quarter. I have no problem with the cafes and the restaurants and everybody getting from 13 to 9. But Jesus, if we could get 13 or if we could even get to 20, it'd make a huge amount of difference. Because do you know the way in America you buy your thing and then you go up to the desk and then the tax is put onto it?
Yes.
So people see the amount of tax that they're paying. Whereas everything you buy, all the clothes, shoes that you buy, all have 23% VAT on them. That's an awful lot.
Mm-hmm.
The government gets that 23%, but we pay the light and the heat and the wages and the rates, and we pay for the goods. And like, we don't come out with 23%. Mm-hmm. And then if we do come out and make any kind of a profit, they tax us on that as well. But that's the whole other issue. And my big bugbear is, my little rant is,
go for it, Deirdre.
School uniform. There should not be VAT on school uniform. The way the VAT system works is there's no VAT on small children's clothes up to age 11 or size 32. So that means your secondary school kids are paying 23% VAT on all their uniforms. So say a jumper that's €50, that would only be €40. And that, you can't tell me that that wouldn't make a difference to every family mm-hmm. in the country that has kids in school. Do you know, like a full school uniform, crested, all that, could be a coat and everything, could be €200. €46 of that is VAT. That €46 would be better in people's pockets.
You raise an interesting point, all right. You're also bringing us back to controversial budgets in the past where things like tax on children's shoes led governments to fall and things
absolutely.
Like that.
Absolutely. They fell on that one they might fall on this one the next time around.
Well, I don't know. They seem safe enough. They're very assured in saying we've got our 5-year term to get those things we didn't get to this time or in future budgets. But just to be clear, there's a tax exemption for children's clothes up to a point. Is that what you're saying?
Up to a point, yeah. So up to age 11 or size 32. But say you have a 10-year-old in national school and say he or she is wearing 12 to 14 clothes. Well, then you're paying VAT on it. You're paying 23% because our invoices come in and only up to a certain size is exempt from VAT. Mm-hmm. And all the secondary schools clothes, like unless they're tiny, all have 23% VAT on it as well.
But isn't there, Deirdre, like, I can hear a minister in my ear almost saying, isn't there a back-to-school clothing and footwear allowance? And didn't they extend it to even younger children yesterday or the day before yesterday?
But everybody doesn't get back to the back-to-school allowance. Like, they're all going on about the people that get up early in the morning and go off to work. Most of them won't have got a back-to-school allowance. Like, for your people that are paying the mortgages and, you know, doing everything, not everybody gets mm-hmm. all the grants. There's that squeezed middle. But also, just as a point of principle, if you're in school, that's the uniform, you have to wear it. There shouldn't be VAT on it. Now, that's just my opinion, and I'd say if people realise that they do pay VAT on it, that they will, agree with that as well. But now, we just do a small amount of school uniform, like our main thing would be fashion and communion and Mother of the Bride and all that sort of stuff. And so it would be the 23% on that. Like, if we got even a small reduction on that, it would help us. Like, do you know, they're saying that the 13 down to 9 is going to keep businesses open. If we got from 23 down to 20, it would help us.
But isn't it different? You know, because what I said earlier on, that Taoiseach was saying that the 9% VAT rate should be reflected in the amount you're paying at your local cafe for your lunch or your your breakfast or dinner or whatever. When you're buying clothes from you in McMullen's in Arklow, Deirdre, and I'm sure it's a great place if you're selling for almost 100 years.
It's wonderful. You'll have to come down when we're having our 100 year celebration.
You may not have anything in my size, Deirdre, though. You may not have what I'm looking for, but I'd love to have a look.
Is that a challenge?
Yes, Deirdre, I assure you it is.
My
question is, Deirdre, with respect, no, you're fine, I'm enjoying the crack, but I can hear people saying out there, there's a big markup on clothes, boutiques can be very expensive, don't you make a lot more profit than my local cafe for its sandwich and its coffee?
But you have to remember, it's on all clothes. It doesn't matter whether it's in McMullen's, whether it's in Brown Thomas, or whether it's in Dunn Stores. It's 23% on everything. And it's not like that's the other thing. Pascal was on the other day and he was saying that he collects the VAT. He doesn't collect the VAT. I collect it and then I pay it to him every two months. And so does every shop and retailer in the country.
I think anybody, who signs up for VAT, particularly the small businesses, do feel like a bit of a tax collector sometimes. Yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And like the thing is, so say somebody's coming into me and they're looking at something and it's €50 and they kind of go, oh, I don't know whether I'll, you know, buy that or not. But if it was €40, they might buy it. So therefore, I will have more custom and more of a turnover. And the other thing that they did in the budget as well. Now, I do not have a problem with the minimum wage going up because my most important asset, our most important asset, is the girls. Like there's six of us here and like they run the shop. They are the business of the face of the business. Okay. So I don't have a problem with any of that. But the government doesn't pay the increase. That's like me saying, OK, Friday, everybody can have a free pint because it's not costing me anything. Joe, they said that that's what they did for the workers, that they put up the minimum wage. But that's not the government doing that. That's the employers doing that. But that was an aside rant.
Deirdre, it was a good rant. And thanks so much for getting it off your chest here on Liveline. It's 0818 715 815. And continued success to McMullen's in Arklow. Derek, good afternoon to you.
Hello.
Derek, you're going to your local cafe. I'm wondering, do you think you should be getting a lower bill? Should the coffee be getting cheaper because of the VAT rate?
No, because the local cafe or shop that you go to with three or four staff has a small turnover. And if the average coffee price now is probably €4. So 4% of €4 would mean that instead of being €4, it might cost you €3.84, which isn't going to make much difference. But in the roundabout way that the shops would sell so many that at the end of the year they might have a little bit more profit and keep their heads above water, I've no issue with that at all. I think that is actually a good idea. There should be a limit put on it. Say a turnover of 100,000, 250,000 maybe. But the issue I have is the likes of McDonald's. If you study their economics, even leaving state economics, they work on a thing called a high turnover, low profit. McDonald's will probably make 4% on each item they sell, but they sell so many millions, it becomes a fairly big profit at the end of the year. Now, by giving them a 4.5% cut, that's going to practically, if actually more than double their profit.
Did you hear Derek the Taoiseach pointing out that McDonald's has franchises right around the country, locally owned franchises, locally operated, employing local staff? They need to support them too.
Yeah, but they have massive turnover. Like, for argument's sake, my local coffee shop might make a couple of hundred euro a turnover every day with maybe one or two staff in it. Whereas, like McDonald's, even in country places, away from major cities, they're still doing a massive big turnover. They're doing the home deliveries, they're doing all. So they are making a big profit. But I would have thought it should have been, I'd say, on the first 100,000 maybe. And they should have been able to work that out. It's somewhere around there. It's just that I think it's very unjust because...
And this is the one, Derek. Yeah, this is the one, Derek, people keep asking, you know, could it not be for a smaller business with smaller profits? Yeah. The Department of Finance telling us that Irish VAT law is governed by EU VAT directives. It's not possible to have different VAT rates depending on your turnover. And there's no mechanism to have the Minister for Finance limit the application of the VAT rate within a sector or depending on how the ownership of a company either. What do you think of that?
Well, to be honest, I'd say it's like Italy, Germany, France, All them other countries, they have their own. They have their own tax systems. They say they're slightly different to ours. So each country should be able to set its own tax. I don't. As far as my reading of it is that it's up to each country to decide what way to.
Well, the EU
taxes.
VAT directive. We're told maybe it's one they'll have to study from other countries as well. You've got another call there, Derek. Go take it, and thanks so much for talking to me as well. We've got more calls to come as well. 51551.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815.
And 51551, many people hoping for big news in terms of peace in the world today as well, because there is broad welcome to news of the first phase of a ceasefire deal in Gaza. The US President Donald Trump announcing last night that Israel and Hamas have agreed to the first phase of the ceasefire in Gaza after days of indirect talks, after 2 years of war and after many, many thousands of deaths and much suffering for those still in Gaza. Shireen is in County Roscommon. Good afternoon, Shireen.
Good afternoon. Hi, how are you?
And thanks very much for joining me. It's John Cook here with you. And Shireen, I've met you before, so thank you for talking to us as well. I met you in Ballyhadreen, but I know that I remember you meeting the Taoiseach at the time and you wanted to raise the plight of your family in Gaza. Have you heard from your family in Gaza today since this news?
Thank you so much for having me. It was actually when I met the Taoiseach was for my mother. I was trying to rescue my mother and she is here.
Yes.
Thanks to the Irish government that they had me to rescue her and she is here. Now it's been 6 months. So I still have my brother and his family are trapped in Gaza and I'm trying to get them out. So I'm hoping that I will be successful with that. Of course, it's going to be with the help of the Irish government to bring them here to safety.
Shireen, you've been through so much. You safely got your mum from Gaza to Ireland with you. And I know you're worried about your brother and his family. A lot of people woke up to news that sounded very hopeful, albeit they have a cautious optimism about it as well. Mm-hmm. You know Gaza more than any of us and your family there still very vulnerable here, I'm sure. What does the news mean to you, or what was your response to this first phase of a ceasefire deal?
Before I say what I really think about that, which I will say it, but I just want to highlight that Donald Trump's 20-point plan to end Israel's genocide is in Gaza is not all-encompassing peace plan. It's a ceasefire deal, and the only other option on the table was endless slaughter and starvation. Of course, I and my family welcome the ceasefire, and we hope that it will bring an end to the genocide and allow aid to provide a essential baby formula and other food, medicine and clean water. I dearly hope that the genocide will stop. Yes, I never know from one day to another if my brother, his wife and 4 children who are still trapped in Gaza will even be alive. And it's the same for all families in Gaza. Now, I just want to highlight another thing, that the aid has been almost completely blocked since Israel broke the last ceasefire back in March this year. At that time, after some of the hostages were released, Israel broke the agreement to move on to phase two. So I'm really worried that once the hostages are released, Israel will again break the ceasefire as they have done in the past. And also, it's very difficult for Palestinians to have confidence in a plan drawn by Trump, which Palestinians had no part in. Mm-hmm. Remember, it was mostly the U.S., and some EU countries who supplied weapons to carry out the genocide. There is no timeline for Israeli withdrawal from Gaza. In the first phase of the plan, Israel will still have military control over most of Gaza, apart from a narrow strip in the south. Mm-hmm. So this plan is like, and the plan vaguely mentioned some kind of Palestinian governing body sometimes in the future, which Trump and Tony Blair will oversee.
Okay, there's a lot to take in, Shireen, and I know you know it more than most of us. There's a lot of hope, obviously, that the Israeli hostages will be released too, that peace will come from both sides here. You sound sceptical at this stage, or do you have any new hope today? Because you've been here before, I suppose.
As I said, I'm really I welcome the ceasefire so that my family and others in Gaza will stay alive. But my immediate worry, as I said, is that Israel will again break the ceasefire. And my long-term worry is that there is no clear plan in place with timelines which will bring a long-term peace and justice for Palestinians. And also there is no clear timeline to bring an end to the illegal Israeli occupation of Palestine. I'm just afraid that that there is no concrete plan, even if the ceasefire holds, there is no clear plan for how to make it possible for the people in Gaza to actually survive.
Shireen, take me back to your brother and his children. Where are they exactly? Do you know? And do you know of their situation right now today? Because we're hearing stories of celebrations on the streets in Gaza and in Tel Aviv. What about your brother? Where is he? And is there any sense of that where he is?
I wish I could celebrate like many others. And really, when it comes to talk about my brother and his family, I get very quickly emotional because they have. First of all, they were living in the north part of Gaza near Shifa Hospital, and they had to leave like many other families. They had to be displaced again and go to south of Gaza, not because south is safe, just because if they don't hear and they don't listen to the Israeli military, what they say, they will be killed. And that's why they went and left their home. That was a few weeks ago, and now in the south of Gaza. Basically, they're homeless. I don't have regular contacts with them because there is no regular internet connection.
I think when we spoke before that you could communicate with them. You don't know is the answer to how they are today. That must be very difficult, Shireen.
No. And I like it was quickly when I wanted to call them, I would get on the phone, I quickly call them. Now with the lack of phone calls and internet, it's constant fear and worry. I wish this nightmare could completely stop and go back to a bit of normality, though things were not and never been normal for the Palestinians. But this, I don't feel 100% optimistic about it.
And I understand. How's your mum feeling today? How's she settling in Ireland? And I'm sure she's always thinking of her son and grandchildren at home as well.
Of course, yeah. She loves Ireland and she thinks Irish people are warm and welcoming. And she sees that everywhere we go. But as you said, she's very worried about her son and her grandchild, especially that she was there and she knows what is it to be starving and not having food. I just want to highlight something that hundreds of people in Gaza have already died from starvation. Mm-hmm. And she knows that. And hundreds of thousands are suffering from extreme malnutrition. So even if this ceasefire holds, there are a lot of people, and including my niece, who has been sick for many times because of lack of food and because of malnutrition and because of lack of medication. And she is going to grow up with serious problems in her kidney.
Mm-hmm. How old is she, Shireen?
She's only 10 years of age. She's only 10 years of age. And she has that, and she's growing up with that. That breaks my heart and breaks everyone's heart. And I just hope that this is going to end, really. And my mother is like, she still has a sister who's still under the rubble. So today, when she was hearing the news about the possible ceasefire, she didn't know whether to cry and grieve the death, and not only death, it's a killing of her two sisters and cousins and nieces and nephews. One of her sisters sitting under rubble, one of her nieces, and along with other cousins and nephews are still under the rubble. So, and this is since last year. And the neighbors across the road, the two families who were killed by Israelis since March 2024, the house that was badly damaged, our home is badly damaged. There are a lot really to go through, like, and many families and other families in Gaza to grieve, and it is a serious trauma, and I feel sorry for my mother that she didn't have the proper time to deal with it and to grieve even the loss of her two sisters and nieces and cousins and nephews.
Shireen, thank you
sure
so much.
Her son is okay. Thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you so
for
much,
this.
Shireen.
Again,
I know you have to go as well, but thank you so much for your time there. And my very best to you and to your mum and to your brother and your family, your 10-year-old nieces, you mentioned, and other family and relatives there. Sadly, others lost as well in the war as well. And we are hopeful, as Shireen is, albeit very, very difficult to be optimistic at this stage yet, but there is hope that there is a new plan here that can be agreed on and that will lead to peace for those in Gaza and Israel. It's 51551 if you want to get in touch with us.
Get in touch with Liveline on 0818 715 815.
51551 for your text as well, or 0874848888 on WhatsApp. Good afternoon, Alistair.
Hello, John.
Thanks very much for joining us on Liveline as well. Tell me why you got in touch.
Yeah, I got in touch with you. I was listening to your program yesterday about the tariffs of product going out to America.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in the book world. We run a website selling online, books.ie, and we sell books to America, and they've all come back. So we use just, I wanted to explain, we Unpost have said that that low orders will get through all books that are mentioned as gifts and that there will be a change. I kind of doubt that because we do a lot of small orders to America.
What kind of books are you selling to America, Alistair?
Every kind of books. Some are Irish language, and then also anything under the sun, you know. So mainly general books, not educational. So there's a huge, you know, a lot of Americans are of Irish descent, and also they like buying from us. It used to be great because Brexit meant a lot of UK orders would find our way from here now, you know, from Ireland. So I think all Irish booksellers who are selling online must be having similar problems to us. So the books are going to Unpost. Unpost use USPS in the U.S., their hub is in New York and possibly elsewhere. But when they get there now, the customers are being sent customs notes that they need to pay tariffs. And I don't even know how much the money is, but we've had these all coming back. We get multiple reasons. They say we haven't given a tariff code, which we have, and Unpost are very good at that, and also refuse because the people don't want to pay the fees. So we've had to refund a whole lot of orders that have gone through, and we've had to switch the USA off our website. So we won't take any orders from there until things change.
Okay, so that's a significant loss of business, is it, Alistair?
Yeah, I wouldn't say. Fortunately, we have grown our local business.
Okay, and that's good to hear.
We're blessed with that. But we do, yeah. So the American market, though, we were starting in COVID, we were very strong in America. And since COVID, it's been getting less and less. So it's not just all to do with Trump, but the Trump one now has been the final death knell, if you want to call it that. And we hope it changes. But the idea that once the customs officials there get their act together, it will be all fine, I've got huge doubt about that.
I want to know more about these refunds, though, and what your customers are saying to you. Can you give me an example, Alistair, of a book you sold to the States recently, or many of them, that then have been returned? Or what has been the cost or the additional cost faced?
Yeah, we have a shipping rate that we get through Unpost, and it's quite a reasonable rate, and that's why we use them. I think the important thing to say, if you used a courier company like, you know, DHL or one of them, you would pay a lot of money to get your book there door to door. And it would be nice to do that, but no customers can afford that. So, there's all kinds of books. There can be a new book, but people are very savvy over there. They know new books that are coming out. A book that would cost around, you know, €12.99, €15.99. And it gets sent off over there. So it goes in a very easy way. And normally, in America, we were able to turn on plus 10 books around within 3, 4, 5 days.
Okay, but my question, Alistair, is more about, as the customer there, they buy a book from you, a book in Irish or a book about Irish heritage, yes, or something like that. Yes. I'm not sure, is it 20 or 30 euro maybe? What have they been hit with in additional cost because of the tariffs then? Why have they sent them back?
I did ask them if they could let me know, but none of them came back to me on that. That was a secondary email to them. All of them.
Well, is it 15% is what I'm wondering?
Yeah, I haven't got a clue. I wish I knew myself. But once we did our refunds, we haven't been in touch now with any American customers because they're not buying. Mm-hmm. So I'm still trying to find that out. I possibly will get that somewhere in the future. It would be probably around that.
What's been the attitude of your customers in America, Alistair, making their returns to you?
Well, I think they. I feel sorry for them.
So what have they said to you?
We've refunded all of them. Sorry?
What
did they say to me?
They're pretty annoyed, I'm thinking.
Yes. Oh, yes. I've got a few emails, if I can find them. One was scathing about Donald Trump and saying to me, reassuring me that they were no fan of Donald Trump and they wish it would all end soon. You know, their whole ability to bring in any product there is becoming impossible. Mm-hmm. So I'll just
you're sending back a lot of refunds. That's not the way you like to do business. It's not the way this is supposed to work, Alistair.
No, I've actually said here, I'm reading what I've sent, my message. Sad days for all of us as we have had to suspend our service to the USA until there is a change in the system. We've been inundated with returned orders from the US due to the customs being charged. I've refunded your order and you should receive email notification. Okay. I wish you all the best and look forward to better days ahead. So these are just salt of the earth type of people, you know. They just want to live. They're not even wanting to get into politics.
I hope there's better days ahead for your business, Alistair. Difficult to have to switch off your American customers there from your books.ie business. Alistair, thanks for joining us as well. 51551 if listeners want to get in touch, or 0818715815. I want to know if you're an American country music fan. Many of you are, I know, and do get in touch. What do you think about Luke Combs? It's just been announced that he's set to headline Slane Castle in County Meath next July. It's part of his My Kind of Saturday Night tour of Europe and North America. It's Luke Combs. And to tell me a little bit more about it, I'm joined by Donegal, or he's a Donegal country singer, David James. Good afternoon, David.
A very good afternoon. Delighted to be on the programme.
Tell me, for anyone who doesn't know Luke Combs, how big a deal is this, him coming to headline Slane next year?
Well, Luke Combs is now an international artist. You know, at 35 years of age, has been out and about at the top of the charts there for the last maybe 6 or 7 years. And it's huge news for country music as a whole, but also huge news for the Irish country music market, which, of course, as we know, is a huge market in itself.
Are you a fan yourself, David?
Yeah, a massive fan of Luke Combs, and also a massive fan of what he has done for country music as well.
Mm-hmm. You know what? I'm going to hold my hands up and say that until last year, I didn't know who Luke Combs was at all, until he started singing one of my favourite songs, because I'd say the first CD or tape I ever owned was Tracy Chapman singing about a fast car. Isn't that the guy, Luke Combs, that did the cover version of Tracy Chapman's Fast Car and did an amazing collaboration, a duet with her as well for the Grammys?
You're 100% right. He released that back in 2023 and put it back to the top of the charts again. And once a great song, always a great song. And I think that he really did that one justice and brought that song. You know, everyone knows that. And even the younger generation, it's one of those songs that we just know. And he put it back to the top of the tree again.
Mm-hmm. We're trying to decide which one we play here now. Hurricane is one of his, Fast Car as well as my favourite as well. 51551 if listeners want to get in touch with us as well about Luke Combs. Doesn't it say a lot about country music, though, the way things are maybe changing as well, David? It was always there. It was always big, but it's becoming much bigger, and we've seen some huge acts selling out in Ireland, now headlining Slane Castle as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It shows how strong country music is, both at a small level here in Ireland. You know, the circuit that I would be working is very, very strong, and we operate in that circuit 52 weeks of the year. But then it also shows how huge it is at an international level. You know, we've seen Garth Brooks come here and sell out five nights at Croke Park. Luke Combs now coming to Slane Castle. And, you know, I suppose it's showing that country music is probably the strongest genre out there at the moment. Like, you know, I don't know of any other genre that could do and achieve what that has done. And recently they actually celebrated 100 years of the Grand Ole Opry. And they brought the Grand Ole Opry for the very first time outside of the United States. They brought it over to London. Again, just showcasing that there's, if nothing else, a real hunger for country music.
We had Zach Bryan as well doing so well in Dublin. Now it's Luke Combs, and country music fans are delighted. And let's hope it does great things for other artists here too as well. David, continued success to you as well. David James there, thank you for joining us on Liveline. It's 0818 715 815. Luke Combs headlining Slane next July, and joining him will be The Script and also American country musician Ty Myers and country music trio The Costello. Let us know if you're a fan. 51551. Luke Combs becoming the first country music star to headline Slane Castle, which of course has previously played host to U2, Madonna, Eminem, David Bowie, Metallica, Harry Styles and Bruce Springsteen. Well, now they're bringing country to the country in Slane. We can have a quick listen to my favourite song. Luke Combs, Fast Car. It's Tracy Chapman's.
Get a fast car, and I want a ticket to anywhere.
Get in touch with Liveline on 0818 715 815.
And 51551 for your texts or Liveline at rte.ie. Earlier on, we heard nothing is off topic on this show. 51551, as I said, that was what Terry was telling us when she was doing an enduring race to mark 10 years of life with a stoma bag. Nothing she couldn't do anymore, she says, and good for her. I think lots of you are inspired by her too. Molly, good afternoon.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, and yourself?
I'm good, thank you.
Tell me a little bit about your situation, Molly.
So similar to Terry, except you won't catch me doing any of those endurance type races, unfortunately.
Don't rule it out yet, Molly. Don't rule it out.
Well, I've already passed the 10 years and the 15, and I haven't done anything remarkable to mark it. So maybe 20, need a few years to train. So I suppose similar to Terry, I have a stoma bag as well. For a similar reason, kind of within the same disease spectrum that Terry has as well. I've had my stoma since I was 17, and I'm 32 now, so it was 15 years this year. Mm-hmm. And I suppose similar to Terry, just always trying to get the message across that, you know, it's not as scary as it sounds, and actually it can be a blessing in disguise, and life goes on, and you can build your confidence back up, and yeah, mm-hmm. all that good stuff.
And Molly, 32, as you said now, compared to Molly, age 17, how different is life?
Very different. And sometimes I think my life didn't necessarily go in the direction that I planned. But I think when you're
who's Dave,
you know,
Molly?
16, 17, exactly. I was going to say, when you're 16, 17, you have all these ideas of how your life is going to go. And in my case, you know, it wasn't necessarily the illness that changed the direction of my life. You know, would that have happened anyway? Who knows? But yeah, I suppose me at 32, you know, I'm a lot more confident. I've had the bag for almost as long as I didn't have it. So I kind of don't really know any difference anymore. It's just become such a part of me and such a part of my life. But yeah, just never. I suppose when I first got it at 17, I was massively conscious of it initially. And, you know, I really did have to work on building my confidence back up. And now my confidence is almost unshakable, I would say. And it certainly isn't shaken by, you know, comments or anything like that about the bag. Certainly not at all. So, yeah, definitely have developed, I suppose, as a person and come to that kind of self-acceptance.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel you missed out on a lot, Molly? Terry, I suppose, explained to us that she's living a full life now since the stoma bag and has no regrets.
Yeah, like, I suppose back then I did. Like, my story was quite... it progressed quite quickly. So I became kind of symptomatic in the February I was diagnosed in the March and I ended up getting the stoma fitted as an emergency in the April. So I thought I didn't have a ton of time to be massively impacted by the disease before the kind of big surgery. Obviously, you know, I missed out on graduating school and everything like that just because of when it happened to me. But I feel like, to be honest, I was so young. You're so resilient when you're that age that, you know, I was in pretty decent health again within kind of 6 or 9 months. So I did miss out, I suppose, in that particular period with not being able to graduate secondary school and things. But I don't feel like I've missed out since. And if anything, I feel like, yes, having IBD, the disease, limits me more than the bag does. And if I had IBD without the bag, I feel like it'd be a lot more limited. Mm-hmm. So if anything, I feel like having my stoma has allowed me to do things I probably wouldn't be able to do if I still had that diseased colon in place.
Good. Good to hear, Molly. Stay with us if you can, because more people getting in touch on this as well. Liveline at rte.ie or 51551. Ciarán, good afternoon.
Hi, John. How are you?
Ciarán, are you up for a high endurance race then, maybe?
Yeah, not today, but I am involved in sport, so I do it as a job. I had ulcerative colitis. I got it late 30s. A lot of stress in life, the recession and all that. I had 3 children. And I had this, the operation in 2013, so it was aged 40. But I was teaching sailing and canoe. Climbing and cycling was my passion. So I found the bag a bit of a challenge for the first few years. But I'm 13 years in now and done Malin to Mizzen cycling and sailing around Ireland and all that type of stuff. So life does go on, and it's brilliant to hear you having it on the radio and sharing, and just let others, you do think it's going to make a huge change, but you adapt and you overcome, and there's lots of tricks to be done, but it definitely gives you it allows you to carry on in life, you know, the stoma and the bag. Definitely, the phrase I always heard was, it's better a bag than a box. You know, at the time when I was chronically ill and getting operations and living in toilets, looking for toilets.
That's very difficult, But you feared, you were gravely ill, Ciarán, is what you're saying. So you...
Yeah, it's amazing how it can come on you. Don't know exactly what causes it. I felt it was just stress and life and all that type of stuff and pressure, but it can come on you quite quickly. And the system was brilliant for facilitating the whole process of medication and changing your life and trying to be healthier in your food. But you could go all the way up to infusion and you're there getting your drip and you're going all your medications, but it just comes to a point where you say it's not worth it. And it's a big decision then to have the operation to lose your colon. And I chose the one that's irreversible. So it was all out. The whole large intestine was taken out. And the bag then, it's absolutely, got me back to normal, you know. You adapt, but it definitely gave me the freedom where for the previous 2 years I just lived toilet to toilet. When I was going to a venue and an event, I would sometimes be just absolutely destroyed, you know. So the bag definitely gave me that freedom that I had lost.
Ciarán, I'm delighted to hear it, and that you can do so much. We were losing your phone for a little bit there, and I thought you were on the bike there. You're so active with your stoma bag there as well. 51551 if listeners want to get in touch. And Derek is on the line as well. Good afternoon, Derek.
Hello, John. How are you?
You're a cyclist too, I think, are you?
Well, I was not so much these days, but
we're lining people up for an endurance race here to celebrate stoma bags as well. But you've done the endurance test already. How's life for you nowadays?
Well, I'm 79 years of age, and I was telling your researcher there, I had my operation when I was 24, so it's 55 years ago, and at that time, the equipment that you had. Your bags, the plastic bags and the high technology bags that we have today, you were wearing rubber bags and rubber flanges that you had to stick to your abdomen around the stoma, you see. So I had a lot of wonderful times there with leakages and life wasn't very pleasant.
That sounds very difficult for a young man to get used to. So technology has changed as well. Things are easier or better now.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the surgeons these days are so much younger and more up to speed, because at that time, back in the 70s, 1970 actually, I had my surgery. A lot of people didn't know much about what Crohn's disease was or how you would live with it, you know, but we survived.
Mm-hmm. Well, well done for surviving and telling us about it as well. Do you think as technology and medical services have got better and made things a little easier, Derek, is it easier to talk about a stoma bag now, or is there still a stigma, as we heard from Terry earlier on?
Well, I never have felt any stigma about it. I just didn't bother, you know. I mean, people that knew me know I have an ileostomy and mm-hmm. we get on with it. They don't take any notice because I'm just like everybody else.
Good for you.
You can't tell by looking at me mm-hmm. or nothing from the outside that's obvious. Uh-huh. All the issues are known where the toilets are.
Yeah. Molly, what about you? Can I ask? Molly, do you think there's still a stigma?
I would agree, I suppose, in that I never really let the stigma affect me. I have had a couple of times, very rarely, people kind of give me a bit of a dirty look, you know, if you're in a public pool in the bikini or something like that. But I'm so unshakable, it literally doesn't bother me at all. Mm-hmm. I do think it's getting better. I think if you look on even the like social media, I don't have TikTok because I'm a millennial, but like TikTok, Instagram, you do see other people kind of sharing their life with a bag and the likes of Terry showing what they're able to do, you know. I do think it's changing. I think there's more of a positive spin on it, but it's like anything. The more you see it, the more you get used to it, the less it becomes a stigma, you know.
Uh-huh. Kieran, would you agree finally?
Yeah, I would say maybe not the one for the dinner table or wait till everybody's finished their uh-huh. meals, but absolutely then chat away about it. Nothing better than sharing, you know. So
well, thank you for sharing today.
Great.
Thanks very much.
Thank
There's nothing we're afraid to talk about here. And as Terry inspired us, nothing is off topic here on Liveline. Thanks to Molly, Kieran and Derek as well. Liveline@rte.ie if you want to get in touch with us about this or anything at all. Today's programme produced by Rachel Graham. Mark McGrath was on sound and Laura Lee Davies is our broadcast coordinator. Thanks to you for listening. Shea Byrne is coming up next. And from me, John Cook and all the Liveline team, have a lovely afternoon.